We're continuing today in our series with the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I would like to welcome Sheila Lewis. She's former president of that association. She's a retired public defender who handled appeals and training. She now works on domestic violence and sexual assault issues for the city of Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And Barry Porter is managing partner of the law firm Burgess & Porter, which specializes in criminal defense and civil rights there in Albuquerque. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we are talking today about the reality that almost everybody who goes to prison gets out of prison and what happens when they get out. Now, what percentage of people who land in prison eventually get back into society?
It's a shocking number. It's 95%.
95%. And so that means that most people don't get life sentences, and sentences range from everything from a few months to 20, 30 years, but the people still land back in society. What is it like for people to leave, especially when they've been in for a long time?
You know, I recently had contact with a client, and he just said when I got out, I had absolutely no support. I didn't know what to do, so kind of just went back to my old friends and the old circumstances, and started using drugs again, and he landed back with me, representing him in criminal court. So I think, you know, a lot of maybe our discussion today is about resources and where we could best use our resources. And, you know, those folks who are reentering the community, and I know Sheila's working with women reentering the community, you know, we have to really pay attention to the resources that we can give them so that they can succeed.
In Santa Fe, what kind of resources are available?
Well, it's not a great situation in Santa Fe because we have limited resources for all kinds of social service issues here. But I think it's getting better. We have something that's very interesting happening here in Santa Fe, which is the PREA project, which is the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And Solace Crisis Treatment Center is prepared to work with any women in prison or in jail here in town who have been raped or suffered from a sexual assault. And so that's a really great resource. That's been federally funded, and I think they're doing a brilliant job getting the message across in prisons and jails. Rape is unacceptable.
How do you go about doing that? I mean, rape is unacceptable. You know that. I know that. It still happens.
It certainly does. You know, we think that social ideas are never going to change, and we never thought there would be gay marriage. We never thought there would be the elimination of rape. Well, so far we've managed to accomplish one of them. I think there is a possibility of really, really bringing down the level of sexual violence against women.
Let's talk about what happens. I mean, somebody gets out of prison, and let's say they do find some resources. Maybe there's a supportive family member or friend or somebody who takes them in, and, you know, that does happen too. Then they go to get a job. What kind of job prospects do they have? What are the limitations?
Well, you know, first of all, they're lucky if they get out. We're seeing more and more offenders who are doing their parole time in-house, right?
What?
Yeah, because they just don't have a parole plan set up. There isn't personnel to help them set up a parole plan. So when somebody goes to the Department of Corrections under New Mexico law, they have to do 2 years of parole for most offenses. Now, for sex offenses, that's a lifetime, actually, the period of parole. But for most offenses, it's 2 years. But if they don't have a parole plan, then they just stay in the Department of Corrections. And we're seeing a real rise in people doing that. So then we're housing them for an extra year, or maybe the full 2 years, when they could have been out in the community had we given them some resources and some guidance. So, it's tough. And when they do have a parole plan set up, then they've got to get a job. But on top of that, they're going to be on parole, so they have to do, you know, weekly or biweekly reporting. They have to do urine tests. Sometimes if they're put on intense supervision when they get out, they have to report every day. So if you can imagine somebody's just getting out from Department of Corrections, they don't really have their community feet, so to speak, and they're trying to get a job, but then they have all these onerous conditions on top of that, it's close to impossible. So a lot of them just give up. They end up violating the parole, and then we're paying for them to be housed again in the Department of Corrections.
Now, when you say they have to report, that means they have to actually go somewhere in person
every
day?
Right. In some instances, people placed on intense supervised parole or probation when they get out, they have to check in with somebody every single day.
So what happens? I mean, you've talked about people who get out. They don't have the support they need. They reoffend in one way or another. Either it's breaking their parole or it's actually doing some kind of criminal something. How do you determine if somebody commits a crime again, whether that's because of lack of job prospects, for example, or lack of support or culture or, you know, what's going on? How do you determine why they commit the crime when they get out of prison?
Well, that's a tall order, right? And there's all kinds of studies that are done about recidivism, right? So recidivism is when an offender gets out and then they reoffend. And I think, you know, Sheila probably knows a lot about that. I know that the number one thing that reduces recidivism rates is employment. So if we can help people when they get out, get a job, have, you know, placement services or job training services, we would really reduce our folks going back into the Department of Corrections and then really reduce our rate of reoffense and have a safer community.
Meanwhile, if somebody wants to get a job, even a minimum wage job working for a big box store sweeping the floor, they can't.
They can't. And that's really what the tragedy is here, because of collateral consequences. We think that when somebody's done their prison time, they did their time, they paid their debt to society, we should give them a new lease on life. And that's not at all what happens. What actually happens is we saddle them with this conviction, which can be found on the internet, on these websites that every employer uses now. And these websites are totally unreliable. We have no idea. They get the conviction wrong, or they'll just have a charge there without a conviction, and the employer doesn't even know that. So they think this person's guilty of the crime. And once you have that kind of a conviction on your record, it's really difficult to get a job. So that's the most important collateral consequence. But there are dozens and dozens of collateral consequences that make life almost impossible when you get out. If we tried harder to make it, we couldn't do a better job at making it difficult to reintegrate. It's terrible.
What are some of the other things that we do in this society?
Well, right now in New Mexico alone, there are 71 collateral consequences. And some of them include things like parental rights. If you have felony convictions and you have a problem with CYFD, you're highly more likely to lose your children. One of the most important rights in the world is affected by it. We also have things like kids who are in school who commit a small crime. They're suspended from school. They're right into that school, public school to prison pipeline immediately, and that's really tragic. Can't hold public office. You can't vote while you're doing your sentence. And what that means is if you're on probation or parole, you can't vote. But in New Mexico, we have a really good law about voting. The trouble is nobody knows about it. So people come out of prison and they all believe they can never vote again. It's tragic, because that's really a part of being reintegrated into society.
There's also all sorts of professions that they're barred from.
Yes, there are. Federally, there are over 69 professions that are barred. Same thing with the state. Getting a license. But we have one very good law in New Mexico that I'm proud of, and it's called the Ex-Offender Employment Act. And what it means is that if you are an employer who gets public money, or if you're a public institution, you cannot put on the job application that question, have you been charged or convicted of a crime? It's called a ban the box law. It's not on the form. Doesn't mean that they can't consider it, but the person gets the opportunity to come in, get their interview, and then answer the question, do you have a criminal record? And maybe make a pitch for why they should still get the job. It's a great law. And last year at the legislature, we tried to expand it just a little bit for certain circumstances with private employers. It was our first time trying to push that law. It will pass eventually, but we didn't do so well this year.
Yeah. So let's talk about a particular group, which is sex offenders. In our collective mind in the United States of America, that seems to be the worst of the worst crimes. Rapists, predators, child rapists, child pornographers. We got a lot of creepy stuff going in this society. There's no doubt about that. But it turns out that people get convicted for all sorts of crimes under the label of sex offender. What are some examples of that?
Well, one here in New Mexico that our appellate courts have recently addressed is electronic solicitation of a minor, right? So that'd be, you know, a detective getting on Craigslist and acting like they're a 14-year-old girl and basically enticing somebody to talk about sex or set up a meeting. And then there's other laws like pornography, different types of laws. And then there's false imprisonment. If somebody restrains a minor, then that also is considered a sex offense. So what I think we've seen, and like you're mentioning, this sex offender kind of hysteria, and granted, it's important to protect children and it's important for public safety, but you don't want to cast the net too widely. Because if you cast it too widely, then you're not really getting the offenders that you want to target for monitoring and for registration so that you make sure that they don't reoffend. You're casting a net so widely, and then you're spreading out your resources, and you're actually decreasing public safety when you do
that. Yeah. I mean, in states far larger than New Mexico, I was reading a story. I think there was one in Dallas, one in somewhere in Georgia, where they have tens, thousands and thousands of people in their sex offender registry. And there was an example of a guy who, when he was 17, slept with his 15-year-old girlfriend in high school, his high school sweetheart. Now they're married and have kids. He's a sex offender for life. He has to register monthly, and he can't do anything. The way he wrote about it is, you can't do anything that you do if you want to be a good father. You can't go to your kid's school. You can't go to their games. You can't go to public parks. You can't go to the movies with your kids. When you look at a sex offender registry, why do you want those people on it?
Exactly. You know, that's the one size fits all. And there's actually some movement throughout the country to have it more evidence-based and more logical to actually and individualize it, right? Rather than say it's just based on a type of offense and then having too many offenses inside your net of you know, really monitoring the bad guys, the law requires in these other states like Massachusetts that there be an individual assessment of an offender and look at their offense, look at their risk, look at the rehabilitation work they've done, and then see whether they should be registering or on sex offender probation. Right, and really, my position is that's what due process requires. It isn't a one size fits all. If you really want to have protect children and have strong public safety, you want to focus your resources on the people that are really a danger.
In New Mexico and in a lot of places, they not only do sex offenders have to register, as you say, they have to do it for the rest of their lives, and then their names and addresses are online. What does that actually look like around the country and around New Mexico? Anybody can go online and say, who are the sex offenders in my neighborhood? Or
yeah, the current sex offender website that's maintained by the Department of Public Safety here in New Mexico. So what happens, every county reports any registrations that are required in their counties, and then it's put on the website. And so you can search, and this is really problematic. I live in Albuquerque, but I can search Las Cruces. I can search Santa Fe. I can search areas that really have nothing to do with maybe my children, you know, or the safety right in my immediate vicinity. And then also, like Sheila's mentioning, and this is a really bad thing in our particular sex offender registry, is you can search by name. So, you know, you're just saying, this is a don't hire me list, you know, rather than a let's keep the safe. The public safe list. It's a don't hire me list. And again, going back to the number one thing that stops people from reoffending is a job. But if you're on this list, you can't get a job. So we're really kind of, you know, shooting ourselves in our own feet.
A lot of this has to do with the federal funding for the sex offender management laws. We have a sex offender management board that tried pretty hard to come up with some reasonable rules and regulations on how to make this work, public safety being paramount, and then reintegrating those people that could be reintegrated. But the federal law requires puts certain requirements on the state and holds out this money that you don't get this funding if you don't follow these laws, and frankly, the money is not worth it. It would be better to just forget the money and make a law that makes sense for the people of New Mexico.
So, do registries, I mean, obviously they were made in good faith with the intent to help public safety. Do they? Do they reduce crime?
Well, you know, that's kind of funny because if we just kind of think from our gut, we think, yeah, you know, if we put a list and we have everybody has access to it, it's actually going to increase the safety for my children. And that just isn't the case. There's been a number of studies nationwide, and, you know, your listeners would really, if they're interested in this, there's a great book by Dr. Emily Horowitz, Protecting Our Kids. And, you know, she's a mother of two and a doctor from Yale University. And she looked at whether or not putting people on a public registry actually reduces reoffense rates, and it doesn't. Right. So then what we're doing is we're just stigmatizing these people. We're putting them on a do not hire list, basically. We're increasing the chances of vigilantism in different neighborhoods. And there is no bang for that buck. So why not spend that buck on what we talked about in the beginning here of making sure people have resources and guidance and monitoring when they get out of Department of Corrections? Then we would really be reducing recidivism.
The other part about this list that is so troubling to me is it affects the family members so profoundly. The children are exposed. Their people in their community know not just that they have a relative, but that they might have been the victim, something that we really want to protect children from, that kind of exposure. But it's right out there. If you're charged with incest and this is the one child, the whole town knows that this, and it's devastating for those victims.
What the studies show is this whole public registration system is counterproductive. What maybe New Mexico could go toward is more evidence-based, is, you know, have law enforcement know where, you know, have people register, right? Have law enforcement still know where they live and monitor their whereabouts and whatnot. And if I'm a concerned citizen, I can go into law enforcement and say, hey, I want to know if there's any sex offenders in my neighborhood, right? And that takes care of even that perceived, you know, public safety benefit that we get. Rather than if you put everybody online and you have this public registration system, it does the opposite. It decreases public safety. And it's unfortunate. If you go to the roundhouse and you say, I want to protect children, everybody just jumps on that bandwagon. And what everybody should be asking is, well, what does the evidence show as far as protecting our community? What, you know, what are the studies? Before we just kind of launch into, you know, hysterical lawmaking, you know, what do we really do to promote public safety?
One of the proponents of change in this area is the family of Adam Walsh. Adam Walsh was the victim of a crime who the statute was named after, to create safety for children. And they've seen that it's gone off the tracks. And they're out there now saying, let's make this a realistic law. Let's make it an effective law. We do want children protected, but I don't want my child's name attached any longer to a bill or a law that really gives a false sense of security and does nothing for safety.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask, what percentage of sex offenders are people from registries?
Right, it's very low.
Is
it? It's very low. And this, Dr. Horowitz talks about that, you know, that's why the registry and the public notification are misleading, because it lulls people into a sense of safety, when in fact, most people who are offending are family members, people that the family already knows. It's not strangers who are on a registry, you know, that are two blocks away. That's just not what the evidence shows. So, you know, again, we're kind of putting our resources into something that maybe makes sense on a gut level, but it's not science-based. It's not social science-based. And we'd be better if we put that into education towards, you know, children understanding about what's appropriate and how to handle things, and, you know, teaching parents what to look out for, and then spending our money on monitoring folks that are likely to reoffend and do have, you know, bad histories.
In my current job working with the victims of sexual assault, I've really pushed hard to get people to understand that our children need to know stranger danger is very remote, extraordinarily remote. These children are going to be hurt, if at all, by somebody that they know. So it's not the person on the registry, it's the person sitting at your dinner table with you. That's the kind of message we have to get across, is children need to be made aware, have to be given the ability to say, I want to tell you something about somebody I know and love who did something wrong to me. That's the biggest problem we have now.
It's funny. I mean, when we talk about registries, are there registries for murderers?
You know, they've been proposed, right?
Con men, armed robbers, burglars,
you know,
identity thieves?
Well, shoplifters. Gosh, Walmart would love to have a registry of shoplifters, right? And the problem is that you proliferate on these registries and then they become watered down and they're almost nothing. That's kind of like, being a felon now, right? You know, in some communities, who doesn't know a felon and doesn't mean anything? And so I think it's important for us to really preserve kind of the nature of what a felony is and have it be, it's a really serious offense. And we're not going to just, throw a felony label on people that maybe rented their car and kept it 2 extra days or, were caught with residue of some sort of a drug.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, if we have singled out sex offenders among all the different dangerous criminals in our society, and some of them are dangerous criminals, but so are murderers and all these other people. I mean, what does that say about our society? It seems like, I don't know. I mean, is this a legacy of our Puritanism?
I really think it's about the shame of family secrets. Because sex offense is really a family secret that gets out. It's very rarely one of these public, the ones we read about in the paper. And I think that's why people want to focus on the stranger danger, this guy with a trench coat at a playground. It's easier to talk about him than to talk about there's something in my family. I think that's why it's been targeted in this way. It's to hide a secret, not to get information out.
We're talking to Sheila Lewis and Barry Porter of the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We're talking about getting out of prison. We're talking about sex offenders. And it's such a complicated thing. I mean, you, Sheila, have been a public defender. You, Barry, are a criminal attorney. When you have, some of these really not so nice people come in. I mean, before we went on the air, you were talking about a guy who came in and was saying that he was a pedophile. There's a lot of creepy people who do gross things in this world. How do you hold them as clients? How do you defend them? How do you see them?
Well, I always kind of back up to the Constitution, right? And that everybody has the right to have a defense and look at the law in their particular case. Now, in a case like that where somebody's basically, saying that they have issues, you try and get them into treatment, and you try and limit the damage on their life and the damage that they can do to others. So I know it's kind of funny when folks think about criminal defense lawyers that you're always just trying to get somebody off. But in our practice at Burgess and Porter, we kind of look at things holistically and, how do we improve this person's life so they don't reoffend and are not back in the system and get them the help that they need. So a lot of folks that I have walk in the door, first thing I do is, hey, you're heading to counseling. And if it's a sex offense, you're going to head to sex offense counseling. If you've got domestic violence issues, let's start getting some counseling done, because if you don't address this, you're just going to be back in the system.
And I understand from talking to people who are in the world of domestic violence and sexual assault that the longer people do this kind of assault, if they come to actually enjoy it, it's really hard to cure them. It's hard for them to change.
Are you talking about domestic violence?
I'm talking about domestic violence and various kinds of sexual assault. There are these cases of people in the military who become predatory rapists, and they like it. And those people are very hard. You send them to counseling. From what I've heard, but you know more about this than I do.
Well, there are some effective programs, and the main thing that we have to understand is we're looking at somebody who's doing an act that only somebody who's had a serious history of trauma would engage in. So what kind of trauma do they have? Maybe it's family trauma. Maybe it's cultural trauma. Maybe they live in a culture that's been essentially raped of its history, of the colorful strength of that culture.
What do you mean? Like, what's an example?
Well, for example, we have Native American people who have long histories of brilliant traditions and language and it's falling apart. It's being taken from them. And you add to that alcohol, you add to that poverty, you add to that isolation from the mainstream. People are traumatized. People react to trauma in very different ways. Some people withdraw, some people act out. But we have to look at it in the context that these people didn't fall out of the moon. They're here on our planet in a culture. And we have to look at those cultural issues.
Yeah, and as we talked about before, you know, recidivism is really the key. You know, when I think of why we have criminal laws is because we want to have a safe society. We want everybody to be safe. And if you look at the studies, again, kind of getting away from hysteria, for instance, for sex offenders, they for the most part, do very well on supervision. They do much better than the average offender in different types of crimes. And their recidivism rate is much lower. Right? So, it's kind of, you know, funny. Sheila's been doing criminal defense for a long time, and I could probably count on my two hands people who were really evil and just couldn't, you know, and shouldn't be part of our community, right? But most people are like Sheila's saying, they've suffered from trauma. If they address that, and if they have proper monitoring and proper guidance and some resources, they can get back into the community. And as we started, they're coming back.
They are.
They are coming back. Nobody's, you know, we can't afford to house everybody forever. So we've got to invest in their return to the community in the most logical and evidence-based manner.
And, you know, the other thing, the sentence that we all live with when we're criminal defense attorneys, how can you represent those people?
Yeah.
And the answer is because they're your children. You're going to come to me one day and say, my son or my daughter has been accused of something, and either they're guilty or they're not, but I still want the best defense possible. This is not, I don't want a death sentence for every crime. I don't want to see them isolated forever. And one of the things I've learned over the many years that I've been practicing is people age out of crimes. They just get tired of it.
Yeah.
Now, sex offenses are different. They require treatment, but they are treatable, extremely treatable. But people do age out of the other crimes, and unfortunately, we don't like to wait until they get too old. If we gave them the services and the support they needed, they'd age out a lot sooner.
So there are so many jobs and so many things that prisoners are not allowed to do when they get out. And I'm looking at this document right now. Limitations on voting, jury service, loss of parental rights, as you mentioned, loss of ability to adopt a child, suspension from public school, service in public office, sporting, hunting, fishing license revocation, ability to carry a handgun. Okay, maybe I can see that. Loss of driving privileges. Some people aren't allowed to have driver's licenses. They are not allowed to have... There's all sorts of things like... They're not allowed to have water quality permits or solid waste facility permits. I mean, there's so many gazillion things. They can't work for the state. They can't work as an accountant, acupuncturist. You can see this alphabetical. Architect, engineer, landscape architect, athletic trainers. Athletic trainers.
Perhaps the most important one, you haven't gotten down to I yet, is immigration consequences. Those are huge.
Yeah.
You can have somebody who's accused of a very minor crime and not even convicted of it, I might add, and that can totally jeopardize their ability to get their immigration permanent, their status permanent here in the country. That's outrageous, because those family, those people will get deported. Some people who have came to this country as children and never don't even speak the language from the country of origin, and for the smallest crime. It's almost like a death sentence to be isolated from your own family in a country where you know no one because you committed a minor crime here. And
you were driving in a car where somebody had a joint.
Absolutely. That could happen.
Yeah, that does happen.
And, you know, as Sheila just mentioned about children and, you know, children who commit crimes, and we're seeing that more and more, but there's some really big implications as far as federal student aid.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the federal subsidized housing that their families may be in, whether they can get into the military or not. So when I have a juvenile coming to my office, my primary concern is, you know, you think, oh, I can defend this crime, but what's your future going to look like, right? I want to make sure that, you know, whatever happens here in court doesn't impede your future ability to join the Marines or, you know, join the Army or work as a healthcare worker or go to college.
Yeah.
Housing is one of the most important areas. We have public housing, and if, let's say, your son gets out of prison and he wants to go home because he has no other resource except his mom and she's in public housing, she can lose her housing by letting him stay in her house. Well, I mean, that's a Sophie's choice you don't want to have to ask anyone to make.
Yeah, yeah. So housing is very difficult. Getting a job is very difficult. You're barred from so many different kinds of professions. You can't be a lobbyist. You can't even be a lobbyist on the ground, like lobbying for better prison conditions.
Right.
If you've been a prisoner. You can't be, I'm just like, you can't be a notary public. You can't be a podiatrist. I mean, it's crazy. You can't be a real estate broker. So, what does society expect you to do? Also, if you do get a job, they can garnish your wages.
Yeah, one of the things that's hard to imagine is that when people are in prison, if they owe child support, that child support continues to accrue. When they come out of prison, they owe child support enforcement all the money for all of the time that they were in prison. Well, obviously, they can't get a job, so they're going to be in arrears immediately, and they can be civilly confined again for not paying their child support. If they do get a job, there's going to be a lien on their check immediately. They're going to get that past child support is going to be getting taken out of that paycheck. So they have nothing to live on in their current. And they can't go live with mom. They can't go live with, there's so many people who can't take them in. It's a setup.
We're not a very pragmatic nation.
Well, what we are is an emotional nation.
Yeah, we react, and sometimes not logically. And that's kind of, you know, what I kind of propound is that, you know, that people ask, well, when we pass this law, is this really going to increase public safety? Or am I just reacting emotionally? Or am I following a legislature's lead because they want to get votes on an emotional issue like sex offenders?
I want to give you some good news. It's hard to come across good news in this area, but for the first time in 40 years since the war on drugs started, both sides of the political spectrum are saying we've made a mistake. Right on Crime is a very politically conservative organization that really believes in reform, getting people out of prison and giving them the services they need to reintegrate them. So it's not just a left-right issue anymore. It's across the board. Another really great, as a lawyer, I always like to hear the law working. There was a group of individuals in Minnesota who applied for jobs with the Pepsi-Cola company, and Pepsi's policy was right on the form to ask about a felony conviction. If it was on there, it went right into the trash. Well, these folks filed the lawsuit, and the EEOC said, because felony convictions are so race-based, because our criminal justice system is so race-based, it has a disproportionate impact, and those people were unfairly denied employment opportunities. That class of people got $3.13 million in a settlement from the Pepsi-Cola company.
Then they didn't need to work at Pepsi.
Well, it was a big group, unfortunately. They cut it up a lot of ways. But it really sends a good message, which is you can't just reject people out of hand, especially in a society like ours where the criminal justice system is so racially disproportionate.
And we're going to be talking about that even more next week when we talk about mass incarceration and the relationship between crime and poverty. Very, very important piece of it. We've been talking about people who are convicted, they get out of prison after a shorter or longer time. Then there's a large group of people who are arrested, they're not convicted. What kind of a record do they then have?
They have a record that is going to plague them for the rest of their lives. We don't have any law in New Mexico that helps somebody who's been arrested and has that arrest on their record but was never convicted. And we're only one of 10 states in the whole country that has this problem. Every state has some way to get an arrest off your record. And why it's so important is the ever-popular phrase, where there's smoke, there's fire. So an employer looks and doesn't see a conviction but says, I don't need that problem in my life. That person got arrested for something that I don't want to even think about. For example, two people are having a domestic dispute in their house and the police are called. The police are going to figure out on the moment who to arrest. And they may find out the next morning they've got the wrong person. The other person was the first aggressor. The other person was the danger. That victim is going to be charged with a domestic violence crime, and nobody wants somebody with a domestic violence charge on their record, man or woman.
And so if they do a background check, that person will show up, even if that person was let free, found
was
innocent.
The victim.
Or even was the victim.
Yes, and I've heard a very sad story in the legislature of a woman who was exactly in that situation. She was the principal of a Catholic school, and turned out she was the victim of domestic violence, but she was arrested for it. She could not practice her profession as a principal. She even felt like she couldn't go back to her church. She felt humiliated by it. It's really a devastating accusation that you were violent against somebody that you in your family that you love. And she begged the legislature, please come up with an expungement. We've had expungement bills introduced. Both Representative Maestas, Mo Maestas, and Senator Sanchez both have introduced them many times. We even had one that was passed overwhelmingly by both houses, but unfortunately the governor vetoed it.
Susana Martinez.
That's correct.
Why?
Well, the police argued that if there was an expungement or a sealing of records, that they would be limited in their investigatory abilities, that they wouldn't be able to do background checks. The bill couldn't have been clearer. It said right on there, it's a public record that's sealed, not the record for the police or even for the courts. The courts will know. But just that fear, when a law enforcement says it's going to stymie us, that was enough.
And this, and our failure in New Mexico to have an expungement law where somebody can is ruining lives. I had a client who, you know, you talked about a domestic violence situation, but I had a client who was accused of a sex offense against a minor, right? And the arrested and everything, and then the minor came forward and said it didn't happen. You know, stepdad was too strict with me, and I wanted him out of the picture, so I made up this lie. So, you know, everything dropped in court. But if you look today on the website, it's still listed that he's arrested and for criminal sexual penetration of a minor. I tried to go to court and had a court hearing on it. And, you know, him and his family through tears telling the story about how they're having housing issues and employment issues and he can't get a job anymore. And the court, because the case law is not really good on this, did not grant him any relief. And not only can you look it up on the website, but you can go to the Albuquerque Police Department and pull the whole police report, because those are all public records for something that somebody absolutely, we know, didn't do, and is continuing to have, you know, just devastating impact on his life and the life of his family. And this was a young guy in his 20s.
Yeah, yeah.
So we really have to fix this issue, and nobody benefits from innocent people being stigmatized and not being able to get work.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense, and New Mexico really needs to move on that.
We have a law on the books that sounds pretty good. It says that you can, it seems to imply you can get your record cleared if you were arrested and not convicted, but that's not what this law actually covers. It allows you to get rid of erroneous information. Well, it's true the man was arrested, and it's true somebody did accuse him, so that's not erroneous. So he can't get that off.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that the legislators had a hard time. They said, well, don't we have laws on the books? They sound so good, but they don't.
Yeah.
The only way, for example, with Barry's client, the only way that he could convince a judge that it should be expunged or the record sealed was to show extraordinary circumstances. Extraordinary circumstances do not include public humiliation, do not include the inability to get a job, do not include the inability to live anywhere. Those are not extraordinary enough.
What's extraordinary?
We were trying to come up with something that's really extraordinary.
God sent a lightning bolt?
I think that if somebody was deported because they were accused of something, because, you know, you don't have to have a conviction to be deported for several crimes. I think that maybe would be extraordinary.
Yeah, but then they're already gone.
Yes. It's very difficult. We're not asking to hide people's records. This bill that was vetoed didn't even touch felonies, and it barely touched any convictions. It mostly touched arrest records. And even that was vetoed.
But
it was really tragic.
And I think Sheila's correct. In most states, a great majority of them have an expungement process. And clients that contact me are always shocked that we really don't have a viable one here in New Mexico.
So you're going to keep trying each legislature?
Absolutely. We know we have tremendous support in the legislature, and those two legislators have really stuck to their guns and really pushed hard for this, and I'm positive it's going to pass. It's just a matter of time.
We're talking to Sheila Lewis and Barry Porter of the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We've got a little time left, and I was wondering if you could kind of talk to us about what you think, like if you guys could wave your magic wand and reform the institutions in which you work, the state in which we are living, and say, here's what we'd like to get rid of. Well, you've already talked about this to some extent, but here's what we'd like to get rid of. Here's what we'd like to do. Here are the most effective and most cost-effective solutions to having a peaceful society with respect to people getting out of prison.
I think the overlying issue is that we have to instill confidence in our judicial system. Our judges are in the best situation to understand case by case what makes sense. If somebody should be a registered sex offender, let them go to a judge, let both sides make their pitch to a judge, and the judge will make a determination. This person sounds dangerous or this person does not pose a danger. The same thing about expungement. This person deserves a second chance, this person doesn't. People have become cynical about judges. They are excellent at making decisions because there are two people giving them the facts from both point of view. And that's our system, and we need to use it.
My magic wand would, well, you know, I'm a taxpayer, so I want our tax dollars to be used where they really work. And the and frankly, I don't find it very moral for us to be posting on the internet people and stigmatizing them when it doesn't increase public safety at all. So I'd rather use that money for reintegration of inmates when they come out so that they actually have some support, and use it to monitor them so that we know that you know, they're doing what they're supposed to do when they're released. And I think we'd have a much safer community.
What do successful and effective reintegration programs look like? Do we have any models somewhere?
We have some really good organizations. We have one in Albuquerque, the Returning Citizens Collaborative, and those are a group of people that get together and try to support people coming back into the community. A lot of faith-based organizations are doing a good job reaching out and saying, let me give you the hand that you need to get help. We have, I know of one woman who was in prison for quite a long time on a charge that was really sounded horrible and really should have stigmatized her for life, but somehow she overcame it, and she's dedicated herself to helping women come out of prison. So she gives them a form, sends it to them, and says, when you come out, what do you need? Do you need a place to stay? Do you need a set of clothes? Do you just need bus fare somewhere? And she raises the money and gets it to them, and that one little helping hand makes such a difference. We've all been down and out. One person reaching out can make a huge difference.
And you know, with that, yeah, there are a lot of great, you know, public service type organization, nonprofit organizations that try and help. But, you know, I think if our government, you know, if our as we elect people and we have people running our government and we want them to create a safe community for us, it's the government's responsibility to set up programs. And my prior practice when I was in the state of Hawaii had a program called Bridges that really, you know, walked people through their reintegration once they got out of the Department of Corrections. And I think that would be a great bang for our buck if the Department of Corrections really stood by these people for the 2 years that they're on parole, and there really wasn't a reintegration program.
If I had a magic wand, I would not make our prisons and jails mental health institutions. I would take all those people who have mental health and substance abuse issues, and I would give them the services they need before they get arrested. The jails and prisons don't want people with mental health issues, but they have become our hospitals. And we can take the same amount of money, it doesn't have to cost a dime more, and just put it at the front end and make a difference in people's lives and really reduce recidivism, which is ultimately what we want, a safe society.
I think there's another piece that, if I could wave my magic wand, that I would like to add, and that is just the piece of realizing that people who get out of prison are human beings, and, I mean, some of them are probably scary, but a lot of them are really no different from you, me, or anybody here in the Santa Fe Baking Company.
Absolutely.
I had a wonderful man who'd been in prison for a long time here in New Mexico, and he ended up living in my house for a year. And most people would say, Mary Charlotte, you're crazy. And it was this guy is like a relative to me now. He's like a cousin or something. I mean, truly a great friend, a great person. I never felt unsafe for a moment. And I got to know a lot of things that I didn't know before. You know, a lot of a person's life story and what they'd went through. And it's not that it was easy for him, because it was very, very difficult and still is difficult in some ways because you are stigmatized. But I think so much of healing from trauma is being around reasonably sane people. If you're around people who are like from that atmosphere that you got traumatized in the first place, it's a lot harder to come out of it.
Drugs and alcohol. We have to address drugs and alcohol in a realistic, science-based way. We can be effective. But if you ask somebody to go back to the place where they were triggered for their drugs and alcohol abuse, they're going to fall back into their old patterns. It's the brain just is trained that way. We know so much about brains, but we need to use that information now.
Yeah, let's use the prisons for the scary people, right? The people who we're really afraid of, and the people that we can help, and there's a great majority of them. I always, you know, people ask, oh, well, how can you do this work? I say, you know, for the most part, the clients that I have, they're not bad people. Right, they've just, you know, had tough circumstances and made bad decisions. So if we can get them on the right path, then we're all better off.
Barry Porter is managing partner of the firm Burgess & Porter. They specialize in criminal defense and civil rights. Sheila Lewis is a retired public defender who handled appeals and training. She now works on domestic violence and sexual assault issues here in the city of Santa Fe. They're both part of the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We're doing a series that is airing every Monday. Next week, we'll be talking about crime and the relationship to poverty and race here in the United States of America. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very
much.
My
pleasure.